I've been saying that shit for years. And if you heard it, that meant your ass. I never gave much thought to what it meant. I just thought it was some cold-blooded shit to say to a motherfucker before I popped a cap in his ass. But I saw some shit this morning made me think twice. See, now I'm thinking, maybe it means you're the evil man, and I'm the righteous man. And Mr. 9mm here, he's the shepherd protecting my righteous ass in the valley of darkness. Or it could mean you're the righteous man, and I'm the shepherd. And it's the world that's evil and selfish. Now, I'd like that. But that shit ain't the truth. The truth is, you're the weak. And I'm the tyranny of evil men. But I'm trying, Ringo. I'm trying real hard to be the shepherd.
Fishnets. Now you only get it in your nightdress. Discard all the naughty nights for niceness. Landed in a very common crisis. Everything's in order in a black hole. Nothing seems to perceive your past though. That bloody memory's like an
earthquake. Hi and welcome to the Unnamed Movie Podcast. This is Andrew.
And this is Douglas. Please note,
we're doing the same thing together. Should we try and do it in tune even though we haven't prepped it? Should we see how horribly we word this?
No, I think I will be the bigger man and allow you to go.
If you haven't figured out already, because you haven't heard his lovely, lovely voice right now, Damon's not with us right now. He's MIA again. I guess the holidays does that to people.
I now have paper planes in my head just going because you said MIA.
Because I said MIA.
Yeah.
I still want to see that documentary. Someone did a documentary on MIA and her music and where she comes from and her family and all these things. And someone put up like this 5-minute trailer for this unfinished documentary.
Yeah.
Of her. And I'm like, I want to watch that. But I know it's never going to happen.
Aww.
Anyways, yeah. Damien's not here, where we'll try and keep it going. Yeah, Douglas nods to me as if people can hear him nod.
They hear the breeze as I pass the microphone, okay? I'm pretty close to it today.
You're pretty close to it.
Yeah.
So this week on a podcast, Douglas, you asked us to talk about the latest Michael Shannon joint.
Yep.
Called The Iceman.
Alright, kids, that's it. Go on home. We're closed.
You got a second?
So, is it my lucky day or my last?
I want to be my partner.
You take care of the details. I do the hit.
Might as well look out for each other, right?
You're doing hits behind my
Well,
back.
This is a movie I've been wanting to watch for quite some time. It feels like, and for a long time, I actually thought this was a 2012 movie. Which,
well, I saw it in 2012.
Maybe that's why. And I guess, in a sense, it kind of ties well into your mandated top five list. Thanks, Andrew. But, so, this is a movie about a really not nice guy. His name is Richard Kuklinski, I think I'm saying that correctly. He was a hitman. He was nicknamed the Iceman. And he worked for the Mafia, or at least a part of one of the families. I had actually already seen... So this guy, before this movie was made... this guy actually sat down. I don't know if it was specifically HBO or if it was something that was showing on HBO or maybe a documentary that HBO bought into afterwards. But there was a documentary that HBO had that he sat down and spoke with. He had a couple of interviews and they did just a general documentary on you know, who this guy is. And you know, he spoke about a lot of things that were, you know, weird. Like, there's a scene in this movie itself where he kills a guy, but he does it, I don't want to say funnily, but, you know, he's very mean about it and very It's something that if you have a dark sense of humor like me, you might find a little bit funny. And he talks about the way that he used to kill people like that. Like, he you know, it's clear that he actually really liked what he was doing. But this is just a really cool movie, and it lets Michael Shannon kind of do what he always does, which is play the badass, right? Even when he is supposed to be, you know, young, lovelorn guy who just loves wrestling. Even when
did that ever happen?
It happened in Back to the Future, Groundhog Day.
Like, I feel like Michael Shannon has been put up as the new hard man of Hollywood.
Exactly. I mean, I don't think I'm trying to think, and that's the only role that I can remember that I have seen. I know I definitely haven't seen enough of his movies, but that's the only one that I have seen and remember where he's not supposed to be like this hard guy. And guess what, guys? It's because it was from the early 90s when he was 12.
That's an 80s movie.
Groundhog Day?
Yes.
No, it's not.
It's 80s Bill Murray.
No, it's not.
Bill Murray is young in the 80s.
Oh, I forgot about this argument. So please, Andrew, before we actually get into the movie that we're talking about, please enlighten our listeners as to the young versus old Bill Murray argument that you have.
Look, Bill Murray exists in two states. There is young Bill Murray, and there is Rushmore Bill Murray.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that is pre-Rushmore Bill Murray is a young Bill Murray.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, because he's a young Bill Murray, that movie came from the fucking 80s. Everything Rushmore and post is present day.
Okay, Andrew, you are a moron.
I thank you for that.
I am glad that... No, I'm not the only moron on this podcast. Hopefully one day we can get to say that Damon is actually... No, we've said that all the time.
Yeah.
Of course Damon's a moron.
He talks about Cobra.
Yes, he does. Even though I still haven't watched that movie. But yes, this movie that we're talking about, The Iceman, it's just one of those movies where you don't have to think too hard. I don't want to say glorifying, but it's really just, you know, a movie where you get to watch a bad man do bad things and feel bad because you enjoy it. and that's what I love about this movie, Andrew. You know, it's Michael Shannon doing Michael Shannon because the role needs it, right? And he is just the name Iceman is apt here. He just plays this stoic sort of unemotional person, except in a few instances. And it's kind of like I was listening to the Bugle podcast the other day with John Oliver, and he was talking about his last day. I know this makes no sense here, but he was talking about his last day on the Daily Show, and apparently they had, you know, rehearsed this bit, and he was going through this bit, and all of a sudden they stopped him and surprised him and kind of did I don't know, because I don't generally watch the show anymore, and I didn't watch that show, but some sort of tribute, or, you know, kind of like, we love you so much, and you know, it's sad that you're leaving, kind of emotional sort of thing. And apparently John Oliver is, you know, very stoic. He doesn't do emotion, but they got him to cry on camera.
You mean a comedian?
Exactly. But they got him to cry on camera, and he spoke about it like, you know, he is a volcano, or was a volcano at that point, but forever, and for from before and for the rest of his life, now the lava has cooled, and he is a hill again, and nothing more will come. And that's kind of what Michael Shannon was in this movie. You know, about, I would say, a good 80-85% of the time, he is the Iceman. But then something big enough will happen in the movie where he explodes, whether it is in anger or in sadness, or just fear for, you know, whatever reasons, whether, you know, he gets threatened or somebody upsets him, whatever it is. But he then just becomes this kind of other person. You know, you see him fly off the handle in rage. You see him become this this almost fearful person at times. And I think that's what I like about this movie, and I like a lot of movies like this, where really, you know, there are a lot of things on the outliers, but it's really kind of a character study, and you get to see one person in front of the camera for about 90% of the time, and they get to showcase their skills. They get to say, listen, Douglas, I want you to know that I act good, and here you go. And, you know, that's why I like a lot of movies like this one. That's why I like, you know, the sex movie. I don't know why I call it the sex movie.
Douglas, yeah? I think the world already knows since you're male that you like porn. You don't have to
talking about them. Blue is the warmest color, okay? because that's one of the main reasons I love that movie. Because
it has sex?
Well, that's not a bad thing, but no, because it really just showcases this one girl up front and center, and she's fabulous. And the same thing here, Michael Shannon is amazing. He is, you know, rock solid, down to the very last T. And of course, it doesn't hurt that I'm a big fan of, you know, crime and mafia type of movies.
So as I mentioned, I saw this movie like a year ago. I saw it at TIFF 2012. And I remember feeling like this movie was a movie that I enjoyed, mm-hmm. but I didn't really want to hold up too high.
Yeah.
Because it, like, the word that came most to my mind when I was thinking about this movie was fun, right? In that, like, throwing away everything else, I enjoyed watching Michael Shannon be badass Michael Shannon.
Yep.
Right? And seeing a couple really crazy, kind of weird moments that I wouldn't have expected Michael Shannon to go for, right? Where, like, I want people to watch this movie so they will forever know that Michael Shannon goes on a dance floor and and has a little slight homoerotic moment, if you can allow. I want people to watch this movie so they can see Chris Evans as this bomb guy who's just kind of like, he's somewhere in between Captain America and just weird, right?
Yeah, I forgot about him, but he really surprised me in this movie. Yeah.
But rewatching this movie this time, all those things kind of faded away from me. Mm-hmm. Where there were still a few moments where, yes, badass Michael Shannon goes overall. But more and more, I just kind of was watching the movie, and I was like, this feels like a real bare bones, kind of dumb, kind of poorly written mafia movie. Right? Where we have all of these elements. We have, first of all, the king of dumb, bad mafia movies, Ray Liotta, who just shows up and does all of Ray Liotta everywhere. And then you have a smattering of all of these other actors who generally I don't consider to be that good a thing, including David Schwimmer, right? I remember laughing at it a year ago, thinking, oh, there's David Schwimmer, and he has a mustache. That's so hilarious. But he's not any Santino, right? From Scarface. He's not that guy who is just always fucking up and against what you're doing, but you love him because he's no Fredo, right? He's no Fredo from Godfather. And I don't mean to compare this movie to The Godfather, but for some reason that just popped into my head. And like, as I was watching it, I felt more and more like how I feel about some really bad action movies, where I get to the point where I'm like, okay, just bring me to the next badass Shannon moment, as opposed to just being like, I'm enjoying having this just stay with me. I'm enjoying watching Shannon just look daringly at this man and go, I'm going to dance your ass off on the dance floor. Like, even when you see a lot of the double-crossing and stuff, it's just like, just please be over right now. I'm kind of meh-ing about this movie. And it's kind of weird. Like, I feel almost like this is what I would have expected to have happened to me with Man of Tai Chi this year, but it didn't. Man of Tai Chi, I still kind of like more. Like, when I was watching it again, and Douglas is looking at me like, Man of Tai Chi...
I'd just like you to confirm. Did you just say that you prefer Man of Tai Chi to this film?
Yes.
again, you are a moron.
Oh, I'm happy you feel that way. I feel so very much more special like that. Because you tell me that a lot about a lot of movies.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I tell you the same.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, like, what was Winona Ryder doing in this movie?
What's Winona Ryder doing in any movie, Andrew? She really should just, you know, go steal some more handbags or something. Just have some fun outside of movies, please. Because I don't need to see her anymore.
And also, like, come on. Like, as much as I enjoy a James Franco moment, like, and that was a badass Michael Shannon moment. Did it have to be James Franco? Like, it felt like
Of course not.
It felt like a choice, which, because you cast such a recognizable actor, you expect something from that moment other than Michael Shannon being great.
Yeah.
And then when it becomes just a Shannon moment, you kind of wonder why.
You know, I think that's a difficult thing to criticize them or anybody for, because they're not the only people that have done it. And you say to yourself, on one hand, yes, if you see a recognizable face in a bit role, you're expecting something big, and there may be some high expectations there that you have to really meet. But also at the same time,
I mean, this was no Disco Santa Claus.
Yeah, exactly. It was no Disco Santa Claus. But at the same time, do you really say no? Like, if for instance, I don't know, some big actor, Anthony Hopkins, comes to you and says, I love this story so much that I would please like to be even in the smallest role of your movie. Do you say no because that man is Anthony Hopkins? Like,
You're right. I mean, it's an unfair criticism to heap on the film. But then again, herein lies the next point. Could it just be a hint as to how kind of mediocre the writing of this movie is, that it just becomes a Shannon moment, that you start to like, if that was anyone else, mm-hmm. any no-name person, you would have been like, okay, I'm not supposed to remember this person, right? But it just highlights it for me as something that's just a negative of the movie, not so much casting or anything, but just why doesn't that come off as anything more special than Michael Shannon?
Yeah, I don't know. and as I said to you, that moment, I'm pretty sure that's one of the moments that I remember from the interview, the guy talking about, the real guy. And I believe he had a couple more that he was talking about that were very interesting. But yeah, I agree with you to some extent. I mean, because I saw James Franco's like, what's going to happen here? And as he said, there was nothing, at least there was no push from his side of the story or the fence to, in terms of anything that happened in that scene, you know?
And guys, can we officially stop casting Ray Liotta in mob movies? Like, can we give him something else to do?
No, you can't. What else is he... He doesn't know how to do anything else, Andrew. Andrew, he does... Listen. Ray Liotta knows to do one thing and one thing alone, right? So much so that when he's on the set, I'm sure he answers to Henry. And they have to do about 5 takes because in the movie, they call him by his character name and he's like, he just doesn't register because it's not Henry. Like, serious?
It's impossible.
It's impossible.
God damn it.
He had one good movie and nothing since then. It's so sad.
Like, is it weird that every time I try to remember a non-mob movie that Ray Liotta was in, the first one that comes to mind was In the Name of the King, In the Name of the Dungeon Siege or something.
Oh, really?
The shitty Uwe Boll movie.
Oh, man.
He was like a bad guy in it, and he was just like, rah! And like, oh, it was
I
so
thought
bad.
You were going to go for one of the comedies. You know, because he's got two off the top of my head. He's got the one with Michael Cera.
Youth in Revolt,
and he was in Observe and Report as well. Yeah, And those were actually like decent movies, you know, or decent comedies rather.
I like those movies. Yeah. But yeah, Ray Liotta, like, there's not much there. Like, he's
Like, he is the... Like, while I don't like to make this a big thing, he is the stereotypical one-note actor.
You see, the flesh of Eve that man since Adam has profaned. That body was meant for begetting children. It was not meant for the lust of men.
I've been bad.
What you been up to, Ruby?
I've been out with men.
This week, I got Douglas to sit down and watch a Charles Laughton film, The Night of the Hunter from 1955.
Yes, you did.
And it's very few times that I kind of force you to sit down and watch like old black and white movies. Like, I feel like there's a push against it sometimes. But I said, you know what, Douglas, just sit your ass down and watch this. What do you think of this movie?
I really like this movie. But Andrew, it still did suffer. It suffered from the old movie itis. So the movie is pretty great. Right,
and you had no idea what it was before.
No, I'd never heard of it. The only thing that I thought I knew, which I realized I didn't, was from the beginning of the movie, there was this old woman that was talking, and the way her voice kind of sounded, I thought that maybe that movie was the source of a clip that was in a song that I really like from Blockhead. Who, by the way, if you guys don't listen to, he's really awesome. He's like this hip-hop producer, almost like RJD2, except he makes essentially, you know, hip-hop-infused sorts of...
Do you want to call him dance?
No, it's not trance? Dance. It's not dance. It's just like instrumentals.
Yeah.
Right? And he sometimes he puts quotes in there. Sometimes you hear like maybe what sounds like a sample of somebody singing a couple lines or something like that. But very cool. Anyway, it wasn't that, unfortunately. So I got my hopes up really quickly and then they were I was let down. Oh. But so this movie was pretty cool for, I guess, you people who don't know what this movie is about. It's about a family that's kind of broken up in a sense, because the father, the patriarch of the family, kind of cuts out really early because he's decided he needs to provide for his family, and the only way to do that is to rob a bank.
That's what I do.
Yeah, exactly. Unfortunately, Johnny Law catches up to him. But before he does, the father goes to his two youngest children and says, "We're going to hide this money. You're going to keep it for, you know, when you're older or whatever." And then he runs off and gets himself arrested and eventually killed. And then Robert Mitchum comes in, because he was in prison with the father and knows that there's money and needs to find it. And so he tries to kind of weasel his way into the family. And things kind of move from there.
And he's a preacher.
He claims to be a preacher. A preacher who is in prison for, I am assuming, murder. And who does naughty things afterwards, too.
It was a
too.
Stolen car.
Oh, was it?
They didn't find out about the woman.
All right, okay.
We know that the murder. They didn't charge him for murder.
Yeah. Anyway,
he wouldn't have gotten out that quickly.
This is true. Now that I think about it, but this movie was pretty good. I liked the way the movie kind of took on its own sort of line. Everything was. There wasn't much. I don't want to call it filler, but everything worked smoothly, you know? And the story was great, and I just really enjoyed myself overall. But my one gripe that I had, and it's a gripe that I have with a lot of older movies, and I know that people are going to probably argue with me that this is a gripe I shouldn't have with this movie because it required it, but it didn't really require it as much as it did. As it had. And the gripe that I have is that Robert Mitchum in this film, clearly, he is, I mean, we all know his name. He is, or some of us do at least. He was at the time a really big actor. And what I notice about movies like that, where you have a really big actor who people love. And back then, I think you tended to love the stars, right? in the 60s or 50s or 70s, no, around that time, whenever it was, if you were a big enough named actor, say a Cary Grant or a Humphrey Bogart, you know, everybody loved you and everybody thought you were good, even if you played a bad role, which Robert Mitchum is doing right in this movie. And a lot of the times in movies like this, it's what the people do, what the actors do is they kind of try to be bad in the best, in the nicest way possible, right? They say, okay, listen, I am an evil person, I do bad things, and I am the villain in this film, but I'm going to be the most charismatic person in the world. Every time I say something bad, I'll have a smile on my face, and you look at it and you'll say, you know what, he might be a villain, but he's not that bad. He's a really like nice guy. Yeah, well, like, I wouldn't say so. I think Lynch...
You still hate Lynch, but you love for hating
him. I love to hate Lynch, exactly. And Lynch is something similar, but different in a sense that it's not that Lynch is trying to be this kind of great guy, right? He's just so committed to being bad and not really... It's like somebody who doesn't really feel that they're bad. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what Lynch is. He's like, listen, I know you might not think that this is working, but guess what? I'm doing all of these things for me, and I'm fine with killing people. That's okay. But but that's different from, you know, trying to be the bad guy while trying not to let people think you're you know, a bad person. That's that. I think those are two totally different things. And in this movie and in a lot of movies back then, that's what happened. And I know that you kind of needed it in a lot of the movie, right? Because the way this movie works is Robert Mitchum tries to essentially get the whole town to like him. He tries to get specifically the mother to like him so that, you know, he can marry her and hopefully somehow get the money out of them. Right. Mm-hmm. So there is actually a huge chunk of this movie where the way that Mitchum plays his persona works perfectly, right? But then there are those, I guess, the other 10%, right? When nobody he's trying to impress is there. There are times when the wife isn't around, the neighbors aren't around, it's just him and the children, specifically the son, right? And there are moments where he's taken off his mask, right? He's taken it off. But to you and me, he hasn't. Because he's still, even when he says the worst things and when he does the worst things to this boy, he still has that, you know, I am a 60s movie star sort of attitude, as opposed to I'm just a lecherous old man who wants some money. And that kind of upset me. Because and I've said it about a bunch of movies, and I know that you don't like me for saying
but
and that's the one gripe I had, but it definitely did not overshadow the rest of the movie. I thought it was great. I really liked this movie.
So alright, there's one question I have for you specifically to do with this movie, and this movie was released in 1955, and while you may not want to say that it was yet the standard that it is today, it was a time when color film was taking over.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious to ask you, because we had that conversation about Francis Ham, black and white. This movie is black and white, and it's very stark and very purposely photographed.
Yeah,
in a lot of its sense.
Yeah.
Did the actual film as a black and white movie and how it was presented to you with its own shadowed imagery, the nightmarish kind of tones that it had, because it was such a children's perspective story for the most part, did that do anything for you, or were you just kind of letting it go past you and just enjoying the story side?
For most of the time I kind of let it go past me, but now that you say it, yeah the black and white kind of did add to the menacing. Yeah, it added sort of a menace to the movie that Mr. Mitchum wasn't giving me. But, I mean, I think that this movie was extremely pretty. And a lot of the set pieces were really cool. I remember that the one point that really stood out in my mind where I took notice and said to myself, this movie is just beautiful, was actually very close to the end of the film, where somebody's in a house sitting on the porch, and one of their children walks down with a candle or a lantern or something like that, and as the child gets closer, and when the child finally gets on the porch with her, the light essentially fills the room, because this is, oh, I should say this is late at night, clearly, and essentially what it did was it kind of played up that whole notion of, you know, when you're inside a house at night looking out, if the lights are all off, you can see everything, but if the lights are on, you can't see anything outside, and but conversely, the person outside can see everything inside, and that's really what that effect sort of did. It was as soon as the light came in, so before she was looking outside and saw the entire yard.
And you saw Mitchum on the outside.
Okay, I wasn't even going to go there, but yes, you saw Mitchum outside there, and then now the child comes in and you can't see a thing, and the brightness of that light just kind of floods the space. Some sort of mesh.
Yeah.
In front of the porch, and it's just, Andrew, that was beautiful. Okay. That was so no, I'm not saying that, you know, black and white never
no,
works.
No. Yeah. All I'm doing is I'm attempting to say, hey, I'm curious if the same thing we talked about two mm-hmm. weeks ago,
yeah,
if you kind of thought you saw something there for this one.
Are you trying to teach me something, Andrew? I don't like learning. I don't like it.
We have much a way to go, Grasshopper. Much a way to go.
Listen here. If you want me to, I will dance around with you and break that cake in your hand, okay? I will show you that I am good enough.
You must first go up the prostitute pole of all of the kung fu masters in the brothel.
The prostitute pole, Andrew. Oh my goodness.
And if you've seen the Grandmaster, I apologize.
It's the questions, boy. It's the questions. It's the questions. Come on. The questions. It's the questions, boy. It's the questions. It's the questions. Yeah. The questions. It's the questions, y'all. It's the questions. It's the questions. Dig it. The questions. It's the questions, boy. It's the questions. So,
So since Damon isn't here, once again, we're going to skip the pitch game. I want to go straight to the questions. And last week, I had put out a call with Christmas having just passed. No, it was before when we talked that last week. I was talking about what people's films that they traditionally watch around Christmas. Not necessarily their famous favorite Christmas-themed movie, but just what they put on. And as always, the internet responded. I want to ask you, Douglas, like, what do you think was the most common response? There is a most common one that got multiple votes.
I think it's going to be one of a couple of things. I think, based on the type of people that I think are out there on Twitter, one might be Die Hard, but for Christmas, probably an older movie, like one of those Christmassy musicals. What say you, Andrew?
I'm so happy to report that you are so very wrong.
Oh, no!
And with a whopping three votes.
A whopping three!
It's the only one which got multiple mentions. It's Home Alone.
Home Alone?
Yes, really? The first Home Alone
movie. The first
movie.
One? And you know what's funny? I remember watching both of those in the theater. But for me, the one that's more... And I know both of them are Christmas. But the one that's way more Christmassy and that I would want to watch on Christmas is Home Alone 2.
Where he goes to New York.
Yeah.
And they have the shop. And they have the Candyman, basically.
Yeah, just, and you have the homeless lady, and it's, well,
I remember most people hate that movie.
We were like children. Five, so of course we love that movie.
But today most people are like, we're never watching anything but part one.
So Ross T. Miller, as well as Shauna, Shauna WTF, and Gareth Jones all put in a vote for Home Alone. Also coming in mentions for films, at Gibby Gibbs, mentions the 1966 version of How the Grinch Stole Christmas.
There's a 66 version.
I'm guessing that's the
cartoon. Okay, yeah. I've seen that before. I was actually listening to the Christmas special episode from NPR's All Songs Considered, and they had that song on there.
Is it weird that I really kind of remember liking the Jim Carrey version?
It probably is weird because I think a lot of people hate it, but I remember thinking it was a young teenager
at that point, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe I can't remember exactly when it came out. I think it was like 2000 or early 90s.
I think it was late 90s, I think.
Anyways, at Lola Lolita, mentions The Sound of Music. I'm not a big Sound of Music fan. Are you?
I've seen it a long time ago, and I recall thinking it was really long. Mm-hmm. But I was also a bit too young to
At Jody Joe 18 brings up this film that I'm not very familiar with, entitled This Christmas.
I'm not sure who's in that movie, Andrew.
It stars one Regina King, Columbus Short, Delroy Lindo, Chris Brown.
Oh my goodness.
Are you okay, Douglas? You've been assaulted by the internet. Are you alright?
It hurts, Andrew. Hold on. Let me just I have to walk it off.
But I think my favorite response comes from friend of the show, Ryan McNeil.
Okay,
of the matinee. Who
Ryan
mentions that now? Other than the required viewing of It's a Wonderful Life,
yeah,
he somehow finds himself popping on The Godfather every Christmas. That's a family film, he says. It's a family movie.
Well, it is a family movie. I agree with him on that point. Ryan, Wow.
I want his Christmas.
Damn. Me too.
I'm lucky if I get to watch White Christmas on Christmas. I was thinking, and I'm not going to put out any questions this week, because next week we're going to be doing our top 10, and we're not going to be fielding any questions, and I haven't really thought of what I wanted to kind of put out there, so I'm just going to throw it out there late in the week. After we do our top 10, and we'll see what happens for the following week of the episode.
Wait, we're doing our top 10 now?
Next week.
Next week? Damn, I need to watch some movies. I'm a puppet on a string, Tracy Island, time traveling diamond, could have shaped heartaches to come to find you for in some velvet morning. Years too late, she's a silver lining, Lone Ranger riding through an open space in my mind when she's not right there beside me.
That's it. You can finish that page.
What did Gert say about this? You just told him how many people you needed and you're not buying them. You're buying them, you're paying him for each of these names.
If you were still working for me, I'd expect you to talk me out of it. It's costing me a fortune. Finish the page and leave one space at the bottom.
list is an absolute good. The list is life. All around its margins lies the gulf.
This week with our top five, proceeding into, before we get into our favorite films of the year next week, I wanted us to talk about our favorite films that we experienced this year that won't quite fall into our top 10. Movies that we saw this year for the first time but were not 2013 releases. Because I don't know about you, Douglas, but mm-hmm. I find myself watching a whole lot of crazy shit generally. Like, yeah. I mean, this time of year we're always forcing ourselves to watch new releases
yeah.
to kind of catch up. But I watch a lot of movies. and I find it's getting sadder and sadder since I'm starting. Like, I've been doing this forever, kind of logging and keeping a history of what movies I'm watching mm-hmm. throughout the year. But now that Letterboxd is out and I'm actually getting a proper count, can you guess how many films I've watched this year?
All right, there are 52 weeks in a year.
And I'm going to allow you to include rewatches.
Rewatches, okay.
So technically every time I sit down to watch a movie.
All right, there are 7 days in a week. Let's say you get through one a day in the week, and I don't know, three on the weekends. That's 5 and 6 is 11. 11 times 52 is 55 and another. 22, no, 550 plus another 22 is 572. Oh, that's a little high. But all right, I'll go with that. About 550.
You're actually really close. Because according to Letterboxd, as of today, I have seen 533 films.
Oh, man! The laws of averages work, Andrew.
This is crazy. Like, I shouldn't have seen this. I remember... It's so crazy. But anyways, so, do you want to start off the list, or should I?
Sure, I'll start off the list.
Alright.
And so, for me, I actually think I'm going to get a Letterboxd account, because I think this list kind of drove home how little I remember what I watched during the year.
Yeah.
Because... And it always happens to me, right? I, at least for the top 10 of 2013,
you have a list in front of you. Exactly. You can go through and you're like, oh, I remember, I saw that.
Right. And sometimes I forget, like last year, the infamous Zoe Kazan incident.
The Ruby Sparks moment. Right,
the Ruby Sparks moment when both of us said, oh, because Damien brought it up. But when I started making the list for this movie, when I started making this list, I was at... I just had a big problem. I couldn't figure out what have I seen that not only wasn't this year, but wasn't a rewatch, because it was specifically something that you saw for the first time this year. Yes. that wasn't made in 2013. And I was at a loss. So, what you will notice is a lot of my movies are podcast movies. Why? Because I was able to get a list of that. okay. I think that number five on my list, definitely a really good movie, is A Vampire's Kiss, starring Nicolas Cage as the Alphabet Man. No? Okay, sorry.
I'm a vampire.
But that movie, the more I think about it, is the more I love that movie. That movie's awesome.
The more I think about it, the more I love the idea of it, but the process of watching it wasn't that great a process.
Oh, Andrew, there are so many moments, and I agree. I think that, you know, a lot of moments don't necessarily come together and add up to a great movie, but at least for now in my head, mm-hmm. I have a good movie. Maybe if I watch it again, I'll be like, ooh, Douglas, what's wrong with you?
So my number five is a movie that I hope I'm not stealing from you, because it's a movie I actually made you watch mm-hmm. this year, but it was also something I saw for the first time earlier this year. And it's a movie that I can't believe I hadn't seen before, but it was Jackie Chan's directorial debut.
Oh, awesome.
With Police Story.
As I tell you, I completely forget things. I have forgotten about that movie, but that movie is awesome. But wasn't that a rewatch for you?
No. When I watched it with uh-huh. you, it was. But I saw it this year.
Oh, wow.
For the first time.
Okay.
And the movie is amazing. Like, anything I had thought about amazing Jackie Chan action at this point was completely wiped away as I got to see the birth as what I believe is the Havana slum scene in Bad Boys 2, or just how amazing this is. And then, of course, I eventually got to the disappointing point of watching Police Story 2, which just kind of middled. But the action in this movie, Douglas, it's so great.
It's fantastic.
Like, I want young Jackie Chan again.
Yes, yes, please.
And you even made a joke to me the other day telling me about the fact that he tweeted out something. He was like, "You guys remember Police Story? I did. Ouch."
Yep, I think that was exactly what he wrote. Or somebody wrote for him on what is supposedly his official Twitter account.
Like, I'm pretty sure he hurt a lot.
Oh, of course. I mean, because he does all his stunts. And you see, in every one of his movies, they always have that blooper reel. Well, it's not quite blooper.
It's the broken leg reel.
Exactly, right? Where things just don't go according to plan. And, you know, he falls the wrong way or something. And, yeah. Mm. Yeah, and I guess it all started from there, because they had it in that movie as well, and that's the first one he directed, right?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. So my number four, and I feel like this movie really should be higher on the list, but I don't think it is. My number four, Andrew, is Perks of Being a Wallflower. And you know, we can laugh all we want about Hermione, but Ezra Miller is awesome in not just this movie, but almost anything I've seen him in. I just love him to death. But this movie in particular,
I love everyone in that movie,
and exactly everybody in this movie is great. And it's just this heartwarming story. And it's one of those movies, because I think it came out last year, and it's just one of those movies where I wish. It's the, you know, Sarah Polly moment for Ryan. It's the Fruitvale Station. Yeah, Fruitvale Station moment for you.
I'm going to get a chance to put that on my list. But yeah, I get where you're going.
Yeah, I mean, I just... This deserved to be in my top 10 last year.
I'm just annoyed that because I was kind of forced into doing a top 10 earlier than I generally do, because I was submitting one to Critical Isle, mm-hmm. that I was like, oh, so this is set in stone, right? There's nothing that's going to beat this in my mind, because all the ones that I have in my mind to beat are stuff that we're not going to see. Right, like the Hers, the Inside Llewyn Davis films. So I'm like, oh, and then Fruitvale Station hit me. I'm like, oh, well. Guess I need to go back to that old drawing board.
Yeah.
But anyways, my number four is a film from 1977. And it's directed by John Cassavetes, a man who I kind of decided at the early part of this year to kind of go through his filmography. And I remember it was one of the most whimsical reasons. I think it was that I was listening to... Girl on Guy, the Aisha Tyler podcast, and she wasn't talking to anyone who had anything to do with Cassavetes, but she was talking with, I believe it was Cody Chestnut.
Wow. How do you... Alright, I want to hear how this jump is made.
And please. Cody Chestnut, I think, I'm trying to remember if I have this right in mind, was talking about a time that he was living in France, and he would walk around talking to people, and whenever he would talk about art... and talk about especially film, people in France would ask him about if he's ever seen John Cassavetes' films. And he'd go, no, I've never seen any. And they'd all go, oh my goodness, you're the worst American in the world, because he's the greatest American filmmaker. And then eventually, just kind of hearing all that talk, I was like, I should go and watch John Cassavetes' films. And that's why I started my list. But the film, there are generally two films out of his filmography that stuck out to me. And I kind of forced myself into picking only one, and it's going to be Opening Night. John Cassavetes, throughout his film career, kind of became known for putting his wife in the leading roles of his films, Gina Rowlands. And this was a film which was about an actress going on stage, an actress who had gotten a little older, going on stage to play a role for a slightly younger woman. And she just wasn't quite sure how to play the role. So she ended up into this cycle of alcoholism, depression, and just figuring out what she was going to do, all to lead us up to the opening night of this play when she puts on that character for the very first time. And I think that movie, more than a lot of all of the film discussions I've had with people, kind of cue me in more into what goes into an acting role than... you might have ever thought of beforehand. And I just love it for that.
Mm. I have thought about watching his movies for an even more whimsical reason than you. I know you've heard me listen to them, but does the name Le Tigre mean anything to you?
It is what, why can't I remember? It is what, it is the name of a Spanish teacher.
So, Le Tigre is, or used to be, because I don't think they're together anymore, a band, I think from like the 90s-ish, around there. And when I was in university, one of my college roommates kind of put me onto them, and I was like, I kind of like them. And they have this one song, I think, I can't remember what the name of it is, probably something like Cassavetes. And all it is, because they're kind of, I don't know, punk rock, something like that. And all the song is they ask a question, what's your take on Cassavetes? And then they just go off and you hear, you know, just words like adjectives, you know, and one of those is a genius. And then the other one's like misogynist. And then, you know, so it's, and that's all the song is, you know, and it's a shortish song, clearly. But for that reason, I would actually watch some of his movies to be like, who is this person that inspired a song like this?
So, you know? Okay. The three films that I would tell you to go watch, mm-hmm. the ones that you should be most psyched to watch, Opening Night,
mm-hmm.
A Woman Under the Influence, another great Gina Rowlands film,
mm-hmm.
and there's another one, I think it's called The Murder of a Chinese Bookie, or Killing a Chinese Bookie, or something like that.
Okay. I will look into it. Or rather, I will wait until you make me watch one of them. Andrew, this year is the year of one Mads Mikkelsen. It's been brewing for quite some time. It started out when a little-known Danish actor became the biggest villain in Casino Royale. And ever since then, for some reason, I remember watching him and being like, he's a Bond villain, whatever. And then for some reason, he just kept coming in movies, because Bond villains tend not to. And you know, for those of you who listen to the podcast on a regular basis, you know that Mads is something of a podcast favorite.
Look, he made the Hannibal TV series watchable,
right? Watchable.
We thought that show was going to be a downright travesty.
Yes, we did. And you know, yeah, this year everything's come to a fruition with Hannibal, with a bunch of movies that he was in, but I watched some of his movies from before this year, and one of those is Pusher, right? You know, this is a movie that Andrew pretended for some time he had seen.
I still because, haven't seen it.
Because he was worried that Damien would kill him. I didn't pretend, but I had not seen. And they're so good that for two nights in a row now, last night and now tonight, I have watched part one and part two of the original, I think they're Danish movies, directed by Nicholas Winding Refn. And they're fantastic.
Does that mean tomorrow will be part three?
Tomorrow might just be part three, Andrew. It might just... Actually, tonight might just be part three. And the one I want to highlight, again, keeping on the Mads Mikkelsen sort of vibe, is Pusher Part 2. Because he's in the first one, but for like 5 minutes. He is the lead in the second movie. And it's just great. You know, and I don't want to try and sell this, because as I think people who have seen his movies know, and people who have heard about his movies have heard, you are either for Nicholas or against Nicholas Winding Refn, right? There is no in-between. And I'm not even going to try and bias anybody to the left or to the right. But it's... And both of these movies are kind of set up in the same way. It's a great movie. It follows a single character. And it's a crime movie. It's really about people in the sort of... I don't want to say drug selling environment, but drugs are a big part of both movies, hence the name, I guess. And it really is about, you know, it's kind of like the Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels sort of story, except without all the style and the panache. Everything's supposed to be great, then something goes bad, and then you have to try and fix it. And it's, you know, both movies are just fantastic, but Pusha 2, I'm not sure. I think it might be my mad's bias, but I actually think I like the second movie more than the first one.
Okay. My number three is a film from 1967. It was directed by Jean-Pierre Melville. I'm ruining that name, I'm sure. It's French, please. Just correct it in your head for me. I'm bad at French. And it's a film by the name of Le Samurai. It is a assassin film about a guy, a lonely samurai, a ronin, who is just doing a contract, and it doesn't quite go so well for him. And while to us watching it, and to him, he sees that while there was a hitch or two, it kind of ironed itself out, he still got himself into some trouble with his employers, because they were worried about the ironing out process and not quite sure what to think, and it becomes this whole thing of him trying to survive his employers and everything. And it's kind of great. I love it for its style. I love it for its just kind of French weirdness that it has to it. And Douglas will know what I'm talking about when I say things like that.
Anybody who's ever watched a French film will know what you're talking about, and that's what I know draws me to them. I don't know about mm-hmm. you or anybody else, but yeah.
And it's weird enough that this was a movie which I watched on the plane heading to Toronto. I was like, what movie can I watch that I won't have to worry about bad words coming out of,
yeah,
that people will understand, and I won't feel like there'll be graphic nudity or violence and people will kind of look at me weird on the plane. I decided it was Samurai, and it was kind of awesome.
Oh yes. Okay, so Andrew, remember how I said I really like Mads Mikkelsen?
I think you mentioned it.
I really like Mads Mikkelsen.
Is this Hannibal now?
No, Hannibal's a TV show. Unfortunately, I couldn't get it on the list. I couldn't bring myself to bend the rules that much. However, I have seen another Mads movie this year, and it was fantastic, and it wasn't made in 2013, and it's called After the Wedding. Another podcast movie, Andrew. Andrew, this movie is so great. This guy, he's doing good things, but kind of just lounging around in third world countries, and gets called back home and finds out something that kind of rocks his world. All of a sudden, he's a father. Not only is he a father, he's been a father for like 20-something years without knowing. And again, it's just, how do I deal with this? And how does everybody involved, because it's clearly not just him, you know, you have him, you have the daughter, you have the mother, you have the family that's kind of been around the daughter for all of her life, that has to be like, oh wait, this person is a thing now, okay. And it's just, Andrew, this movie is great. I think maybe because of recency lack of it with this movie, I'm not sure where to really grade the Mads. Should I like drug Mads more or daddy Mads more? But I think for the moment I'm going to go with Daddy Mads. I like Daddy Mads.
Mm.
And this is my number two movie, because oh my goodness.
So for my number two slot, I kind of just threw in a director, because he's someone I've seen a few films of this year, and someone who I've kind of introduced, but kind of pushed towards you guys, and you guys don't seem to be catching on, so I'm going to just keep him to myself from now on. And he's the Iranian filmmaker Abbas Kiarostami. Let me make a side note with this list. Like, there are probably 10 other movies that should kind of outweigh this list, because I did this thing on my site over the last year called, I participated in this thing called the Blind Spot series, where you kind of take focus on 12 films that are kind of highly regarded that you haven't seen yet, and I forced myself to see movies like Schindler's List and
Fritz Lang's M and Metropolis, and also I even added in Abbas Kiarostami's Close Up into this list. And those movies technically would all outshine my top five that I have here, but I purposely left those movies off the list because I felt most people would have already known those movies or found those movies somewhere or heard they were great movies. I wanted to talk about all of the other ones. And if I had to pick one Kiarostami film this year that kind of did it for me, I think it's his 1992 film, Life and Nothing More, or some people know it by the title And Life Goes On. This is part of what is discussed as the Coca Trilogy, which is this trilogy of films taken within this town called Coca. This is the second film in the trilogy. I have not seen the first. And it's about what happened after this horrible earthquake which happened around that town. And for cues in for the film, the first film was a regular narrative film which took place within that town, starring this young boy. This second film is about this guy going back to go and find out how this boy is after the earthquake. And he's taking us through this town and all of Iran, looking at all of the destruction that's happened, and more kind of looking at how life has moved on after the destruction. And what I love so much about watching all of Kiarostami's films, and I think I can say this of all of the ones that I've seen, is how life-affirming his movies are. Where you're like, there are good things in the world. Like, even when we have this horrible thing happening right now, be it the earthquake here, be it in Close-Up, the actual litigation going on, even in a film like Taste of Cherry, where we're talking about suicide, right? There are a lot of things which kind of make you go, life can be good even in all of these, even in the middle of all of these bad things. And I think this movie, more than all the others, kind of highlights that for me. And I really love it.
Okay, I have no words. But let's just talk about my number one. So, actually, I'm glad that you found those movies and like them, because I know that for you that is essentially my French movies for me.
So I can have Iranian cinema.
Yeah, you can have Iran. I'll take France. Okay. All right. I don't know where Damien is gonna kind of put his home. Maybe
he's
Korea.
In South Korea.
Yeah,
he's in Korea.
I'm kind of there too. But anyway,
no, we all visit. We all visit each other's countries from time to time. But we have a home.
Okay, so my number one, and I'm not sure if I'm bending the rules here, because I honestly don't remember when I watched this movie, but I think it's fairly recent, and I think for this guy, rules must always be bent. And when we're talking about number ones, Chris Nolan rules number ones. I watched The Following fairly recently. What? Boy, okay, so Andrew just gave me a quizzical look, but I shall continue nonetheless.
I'm pretty sure that was a long time ago, but sure.
Was it a long time ago?
It feels like it to me.
Was it?
I don't know, but go on. I'll let you have it.
The Following is a great movie about robbers, but you know what? I was actually worried about that too. I was. All right, so I'm going to call an audible.
Okay.
I'm going to call an audible.
You can still have...
I actually have a couple of audibles here. Anyway, so I hate Werner Herzog. I don't like him. All right. Werner Herzog is horrible, you know? I watched Port of Call, whatever that movie was called. See, I blocked it out so much I can't even remember
the full name.
Bad Lieutenant. I've watched a couple other movies from him or somehow related to him and just been like, no, Werner Herzog sucks. And then, by sheer accident,
I couldn't, like, that was a special moment, Douglas.
Oh, it was. I came across this documentary that he did called Happy People. A Year in the Tiger.
Tiger! Tiger!
And it starred the superest of dogs. And there was just something, I don't know, sweet and... not just sweet, but also, you know, connecting you to the... I don't even want to call it the real world, but to what the world was, say, 100 years ago, you know? And that just drew me into this movie for some reason. You know, I'm not... I wouldn't say I'm the biggest... I'm not a fan of documentaries, but it's not something I seek out. And this one just bowled me over, and I'm actually excited to watch another one of his documentaries, because if they're anything like this, if they are even a tenth as good as this one is, I love it just the same, you know. So Happy People is my number one for this one.
So my number one, you might look at me weird and say I'm bending the rules, but I'm going to count this one as... Douglas might call it the movie that began my pretension, but I don't really agree with him there, because I think I was bent like this a long time ago, and it is the 15-hour film directed by Mark Cousins. Douglas might call him Smiley.
No. Andrew. If I'm not allowed to put Hannibal on my list, you're not allowed to put that long television show on your list. Okay. If you put that on, I want to take back Tiger and put on Hannibal as number one, so that the top three movies are Mads Mikkelsen movies.
My logic is they played this at TIFF.
Wait, how did they play? They played a very small version of it.
They played... like
15 hours straight?
I asked Ryan, because it wasn't a year I was there. And he said what they did was they had two sets of showings, right? Mm-hmm. One which was like two episodes a day,
mm-hmm.
and one which was like half one day, half the other day.
So what? They didn't... What they should have done for the hardcore motherfuckers is there should have been like, we're showing all 15 in one day. You'll get about 3 intermissions, but you're going the whole day. This is a 7 o'clock in the morning to midnight tonight sort of deal. Alright guys, that's what should have happened there.
I'm gonna fight it, but I'm gonna keep it there, because I consider it truly a film. The history of film. It's a documentary about Mark Cousins. I'm not even going to call it a documentary about the real history of film. I'm going to take it as Mark Cousins' interpretation
mm-hmm.
of the history of film. Because, like, throughout the entire thing, he's reminding us that what he's trying to focus on isn't necessarily the highlighting moments of what people consider the tipping points of movie making or movies, but where innovation happened in movies. Right? Whether it be within America, within Asia, within Europe, within even South America, and all of the places where we haven't yet gone to see films, Africa and such. And it kind of is, it's really amazing. I've talked to you about this. You've seen me watching a bit of it or two.
Yeah, one or two. Yeah.
And while I know this is part of the conversation I generally don't get to have all the while, I find it fascinating to see someone deconstruct film the way that Mark Cousins does, and even place it within the context of what was happening with the technology at the time, because it's something we don't see that often. I remember like 3 years ago when me and Douglas sat down to watch Citizen Kane, right? And we kind of, at least I kind of went, whatever. And then
I think not just you and not just me, but all three of us, because Damien was in on it as well, were like, fuck this movie.
Right.
Yeah.
And everyone came back to me with, Andrew, you have to realize what this movie did at that time. And we don't really have that context, because we're not those historians, right? But this kind of tried to give me, for a lot of those points, that kind of context, the social and technological context of what this did for film. And I'm kind of grateful for it forever.
So, what you're saying then is I'm allowed to put Southcliffe on any one of my movie lists now? Because Southcliffe is a TV show. Just because we sat down for 4 hours, because we're morons, at the Toronto International Festival, does not make it a movie. I just want to make sure that you understand it, okay? And actually, I would argue that Southcliffe is more a movie than this show, because we were able to sit down and watch it in one sitting. Apparently, you just confirmed to me that they weren't active for your show. You're a horrible, horrible man. I could have just put Hannibal up there.
God. And then I would have fought it, and then God. You would have hated me more.
Oh, of course I would have.
Let me mention a couple of the films that I didn't quite put into my list. I mean, as I mentioned, there was the Blindspot series of films. I had Schindler's List, I had In the Mood for Love, Metropolis, Sherlock Jr., the Buster Keaton film. But also, I had Diabolique. The Slacker, Shotgun Stories, City on Fire, The Verdict, City Limits, Failsafe. Oh, there's so many here. Girl Walk All Day. Have you seen that yet?
I haven't. I know what it is, though, and it's something that I definitely think I'd like. I really do love Girl Walk. Girl Talk. They're pretty awesome.
And also...
Or he is. He's
the
really
documentary,
a guy, right?
Shut Up Little Man, an audio misadventure. I talked to you guys about that earlier this year.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of great documentary.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't have that many audibles, but one was Trouble Every Day, the Claire Denis horror film, which I really liked. Again, another podcast movie, because guess what, Andrew? Douglas needs a list.
I had a list.
Yeah, exactly, right? You lucky bastard. The Robert Mitchum movie that you made me watch as well was one on there, but I kind of decided against it, especially when you made us talk about it earlier. And I'm sure one is actually Slacker, which I decided not to put on there because technically I had watched it already. I just had completely forgotten about it. but it did feel like a first time watch for me at some points, mm-hmm. at most points. But yeah. I, as I said, my list was always smaller.
Anyways, yeah, that's the show. What was I going to say? Next week we're going to be back with our top 10 of the year gone by. It would be the new year by then, so happy new year whenever you're hearing this. Douglas, where can the people find you on the internet?
Well, they can find me on Twitter. I am DJ, I lost his name.
Okay, I am also on Twitter at GmanReviews. You can hear this show over at GmanReviews.com as well as through iTunes or Stitcher. Feel free to rate or review the show over on iTunes and let us know. Yeah, that's about it. So, bye, Damien.